Hello, George Galloway.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Happy to hear your voice.
Thanks.
We're going to get on to this. Political life on the U.S. left has become fairly dry and boring since the end of the 60s.
Yes.
On your last trip to the U.S., you rolled over the Senate, leaving Norm Coleman's presidential aspirations tattered on the Senate floor. And tonight, a lot of folks are looking forward to you doing the same to that born-again hawk and your fellow countryman Christopher Hitchens in New York. When you debate the Iraq War, whether it was just or necessary, which he never seems to explain why. What do you see as the difference between how the political battles are waged in the UK and the US?
Well, I think with the US Senate, I was aware that these people consider themselves a kind of nobility, and everyone else seems to treat them as such. And that means they're not subject to the kind of rigorous debate and inquiry and journalism that the policymakers are in Britain, for example. I'm not pretending that Britain is a paragon of democratic virtue, very far from it. But one of the things that seemed to really surprise people and shock others was that I was able to talk to the Senate in May in the way that I did. There was a sense in which it seems that there were some people who weren't aware that you were actually allowed to talk to American powerful policymakers in that way. And that's a pretty sad state of affairs. The British parliamentary tradition is much more robust than the much more decorous American senatorial system. And I think, if I may say so, I hope I don't cause any national offense, that the British parliamentary system proved its innate superiority, at least in so far as the exchange of arguments is concerned.
Well, you were one of the earliest opponents of the war, and the pro-war camp in Britain, as well as the United States, tried to smear you as an ally of Saddam,
yes,
which was what brought you to the Senate chambers in the first place to defend,
yes,
yourself. Perhaps you could run that down for us.
Well, as it happens, long before anyone in the United States or the United Kingdom, for that matter, had ever heard of Saddam Hussein, I was one of his most inveterate opponents when he wasn't even the president of Iraq. I was one of the founders of an organization called Qadri, the Campaign Against Repression and for Democratic Rights in Iraq. I was against the Ba'ath dictatorship in the 70s and the 80s when British and American ministers and businessmen were doing a very profitable business with them, including selling them guns and gas and visiting them twice, like Donald Rumsfeld, who went on behalf of President Reagan to sell them guns and to give them maps the better to target those guns. I was demonstrating outside the Iraqi embassy in London when these tradesmen were going in and out, making lots of money out of the Ba'ath dictatorship. But I took the view in 1991, as I may say, as I shall remind him this evening, did Christopher Hitchens, that notwithstanding the venality of the Ba'ath regime in Baghdad, the idea of the big imperialist countries of the world going around invading other people's countries and occupying them was something even worse than a tin-pot dictatorship in the Third World. And that's a position I maintained throughout the 90s during the sanctions period, where a million Iraqis were killed, most of them children. And, of course, right into the Gulf War too, where miraculously Hitchens, having opposed the war in 91, became its strongest supporter in 2003.
You know, I first read about you when you made a trip to the occupied West Bank in Gaza and made one of the most scathing critiques of Israeli policies that I've ever seen from a Western politician. And you made the Israelis raging mad, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What led you to your interest in the Palestinians and then to Iraq?
Well, it's quite by chance, actually. In 1975, exactly 30 years ago to the month, a Palestinian student came to the door of the Labour office in Dundee, where I was the organizer. And said he wanted to speak about Palestine. And at that time, I'd never met an Arab, never met a Muslim, never met a Palestinian. And he spoke to me for about 2 hours about the incredible tragedy that had befallen the Palestinian people. And by the end of that 2 hours, rather mesmerizing discussion, I was a convert. I quickly studied as much as I could. I visited the Palestinians in Lebanon in 1977. The camps at Sabra and Shatila. I became close personally to many Palestinians, including the late President Arafat. I married a Palestinian, and I became more and more drawn into Arab affairs. But the one country I had never visited in the Arab world before the war of 1991 was Iraq, and I would have been arrested if I had turned up in Iraq because I was a known and vociferous opponent of the Baghdad regime. But it's just by chance that I got involved in Arab affairs, and it's just by chance that Arab affairs continue to be the kind of center of the political universe all these years, all these decades later.
And still is.
Yes, that's the flaw at the heart. I said in Boston last night, I'll say again tonight, you have to grasp it here in the United States. The Palestine question is the flaw at the heart of the West's policy towards the East, of the non-Muslim world's policy towards the Muslim world. We just simply don't get it here, that this Palestine tragedy is a suppurating sore in relations between the two parts of the world. They ensure that the twain will never meet, and they ensure ongoing danger for the rest of us. I mean, I always say to people, if I can't persuade you morally of my case, can I at least try to touch you practically? It follows that if there's no stability and no peace in Palestine, there will be none in the Middle East. And if there's none in the Middle East, there'll be none in the world, and you yourself will be in danger.
Well, that brings me to the next question. Those in the anti-war movement who see a link between Israel's occupation of Palestinian land and the U.S. occupation and involvement in Iraq have had a difficult time getting some of the larger movement groups to accept that the two are connected. This has been a major source of contention between the two large groups organizing for September 24th protest. I guess you do see that link. Is that also a problem in the anti-war movement in Britain?
It isn't in Britain, but then Israel doesn't have as many supporters in Britain as it does in the United States. I'm the last man to give you a diplomatic answer, but let me try and give you one on this. It is not a necessary condition to agree with what I'm saying about Palestine to be opposed to the war and occupation on Iraq. And we should not set it as some kind of blood test that unless you are prepared to oppose the Israeli occupation of Palestine, you are not allowed to join our movement against the American-British occupation of Iraq. That would be foolish. It is perfectly possible that there are people opposed to the latter who are not yet, at least, opposed to the former. So it should not be used as a means of dividing people, and it certainly hasn't been in Britain. We, in the beginning of the anti-war movement, did not raise the issue of Palestine. But later on we did, and on the February 15th demonstration, just before the war, the biggest demonstration in British political history to the power of five, our slogans were no war on Iraq, freedom for Palestine. And not only did that not put people off coming on the demonstration, it probably built the demonstration even bigger. So I say to those who share my view on Palestine to have faith in the essential strength of the argument for Palestine and engage gently with people in the movement who haven't yet subscribe to that point of view and not to exclude them or work separately from them. And I'm glad to say the demonstration on the 24th is now a joint demonstration. There was the bizarre prospect of two different demonstrations on the same day in Washington on the same subject. But I'm glad to say that common sense has prevailed and there'll just be one demonstration now. And I, God willing, hope to speak at it.
Agreed, yes. Before the invasion of Iraq, and speaking of the anti-war movement, there was this unprecedented worldwide protest which have diminished in number and size despite the daily horrors that have been reported in the media and the criminal destruction of Fallujah, which we did not get a full report, at least here. What's the status of the movement in the UK today and compared to what it was at the time before the war?
Well, we now represent the overwhelming majority of British people, and indeed the anti-war movement in the United States now represents a clear majority of the people of the United States, which is quite a dramatic turnaround. And when you think of the scale of the bugle blowing and drum beating and fake patriotic mobilization there has been in the United States, the fact that the majority of American people now believe the war to have been a mistake is a very great credit to the country and a very great credit to the anti-war movement, which has stayed the course and has prevailed now in public opinion. And I suspect before long, the Democratic Party will be forced into an increasingly anti-war position, and anyone running for president next time will be doing so in an anti-war, anti-occupation position. That's my prediction. In Britain, nobody really stands up for the war anymore. Christopher Hitchens is practically the last British man, other than Tony Blair, who any longer believes that the attack on Iraq was a good idea. In fact, it was a grotesque blunder, and everyone can see it. I believe it was a crime, but even if you don't agree with that, the fact that it was a grotesque blunder is surely incontestable.
Well, President Bush's father realized back in 1991 that if they had gone into Iraq and taken out Saddam, they would still be there today. One thing that's puzzled me is what the British get out of the war. U.S. firms have made huge profits from the war. Have U.K. industries profited in the same manner?
No, and I told them so before they did it. I told them that if the thinking was that they would somehow profit from the blood of the Iraqi people, they would be disappointed, and that the Halliburtons and Bechtels and all the other vulture capitalists closely associated with the Bush regime would mop up everything, would carve Iraq up like a giant shawarma on a spit. And that's exactly what happened. And in fact, British companies have got virtually nothing out of the occupation of Iraq. Mr. Blair has destroyed his political reputation for all time. He will be remembered for nothing else other than the being the joint architect of this disaster. And of course, there are now 100 families in the United Kingdom, at least more if you include those wounded, 100 families whose sons have given their lives for this pack of lies, for this ignoble enterprise, whose sons lie dead at the age of 18, 19, 20. One of them, a major, just a couple of days ago, an officer, a bright, glittering young Englishman, killed in his prime of life for Bush and Blair and their lies. And this is a very, very bitter thing for British people to swallow. The idea that that you should engage in such an ignoble enterprise on such a threadbare pretext and not even have so much as a row of beans to show for it in terms of commercial advantage is increasingly evident to everyone in Britain, even people from the right of the political spectrum.
Now, of course, it's also has brought the war home with the July 7th bombing within the London Transport and on the bus, which it seems Blair is the only person who says there's no link to Iraq. How do you see that?
He did say so, but he's no longer in a position to, because 10 days after I said it, on the day of the bombings, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, which is the basically the British government's premier foreign policy think tank, declared exactly what I had said on the day of the bombings, that the link was clear. And moreover, they put it more damningly, actually. They said that Mr. Blair had made us the pillion passenger in the back seat of a vehicle driven by George W. Bush, which made us a prisoner of a very unstable driver indeed. So, again, there are not many left in the country who think that the attack on the United Kingdom on the 7th of July was unconnected to the foreign policy of the Blair administration. And there are not even many around the British cabinet table who think that.
When I lived in London some 30-odd years ago, on and off, it seemed to me that while immigrants from South Asia, Pakistan particularly, had been integrated into the economic life of the country at the lower levels, they were isolated socially and targeted by the obvious racist violence of skinheads and the less obvious racism of British society in general. Has that changed in any way, and particularly since the 7th of July?
Well, it's changed only in as much as it's gotten worse. It's been an ongoing development since 9/11, and it is particularly, of course, aimed at Muslims. I say that anti-Islamic feeling is the last respectable form of racism. People say things about Muslims that if you substituted the word black or Jew or Catholic or Chinese or any other racial grouping, you'd be probably on trial for breaches of the race relations legislation. Yet people, including so-called liberals or ex-liberals like Hitchens and co., smear Muslims in the most disgusting way, in a way that they would never dream, at least publicly, of doing of other groups. And the Pakistani, Bengali, in my constituency, 50% of the constituents are of Bangladeshi origin. The Arab population in Britain, there are nearly 2 million Muslims in Britain now, which is a considerable number of people in a country of 56 million. And they are the people on the receiving end of the rough stuff, from the gutter tabloids to the racist policing, harassment of their youth, stop and search, and so on, racial profiling. And they are increasingly viewed by the Blair government as a kind of enemy within, as a fifth column. And this is a very dangerous place to be. And we predicted, again, I must say this, we predicted all of this. You know, if you make war after war after war against Muslims abroad, you will end up having to make war against Muslims at home.
There are many people who see that this, or believe that, that this is an operation of MI5, that Tony Blair was behind these bombings. But it would seem that the very day before, when London had just gotten the nod for the 2012 Olympics, Mr. Blair was on top of the world. It would seem not likely that he would then be responsible for having this attack the very next day.
Well, I completely reject that conspiracy theory, and I'm a bit of an enemy of conspiracy theories, I must tell you. I think they actually, here's this for a conspiracy. They're probably spread by those who want us to go around blaming a conspiracy so as to undermine us. It is a fantastically absurd notion that Mr. Blair was somehow involved in the attack on London on the 7th of July. Equally absurd to say that President Bush was involved in the attack on the Twin Towers in the city I'm speaking to you from now. No, look, it's much more clear-cut than that. There is a swamp of hatred out there against us. Out of that swamp come many monsters. They're mutating and germinating all the time. Instead of draining the swamp of the hatred that produced these monsters, we are watering the swamp with more and more bloodshed, in war after war, injustice after injustice. Until we reverse course, drain the swamp, it doesn't matter how many fly swats, how many Patriot Acts, how many anti-terrorism acts we pass, we'll not be able to stop some of these mosquitoes getting through.
I don't know how much you have seen on TV or read about Katrina, because I want to bring some of this home. But do you see any parallels with Iraq in the terms of the U.S. government behavior?
I do indeed, and I think the world does very graphically. The U.S. administration, the Bush administration, now stands naked in front of the whole world, exposed not only as morally and politically bankrupt, but utterly incompetent as well. A country that cannot even pick up the dead bodies of its own citizens in one of its major cities, 7 days after they began floating or lying there, is seeking to say that it has the right to go around the world invading other people's countries, occupying them, changing their regimes and their political system, and remaking the world in their own image. Well, no thanks. For most people around the world, one glance at the pathetic, poisonous malevolence of the Bush regime's response to Katrina. And what about the comments of Mrs. Bush the First?
Yes.
This is Marie Antoinette. This is
Perhaps you could repeat them for the listeners who may not have seen
them. Mrs. Bush said in terms that these poor people living in these astrodomes and conference centers had never had it so good. They were poor and underprivileged anyway, and they were doing very well out of this disaster. Now, she went on to say that the main problem was a lot of them were indicating they wanted to stay in Texas, and how awful that would be to have poor black people deciding that they wanted to stay in Texas, their own country. Now, Marie Antoinette, the French queen at the time of the French Revolution, when told that the masses were revolting for they had no bread, answered, "If they have no bread, why don't they eat cake?" And this is the level of this. This is the Bourbon level that the Bushes have reached. Now, do you think there are many people in the world want to remake themselves in the image of Barbara Bush and George Bush? I'm afraid not. Most people prefer their own path to the future. Thanks very much indeed.
Well, and thank you, George. I know, Galloway, I know you have to, you have a busy schedule,
yes.
And tonight you're going to debate the man you properly call the Papa J, Christopher
yes.
Hitchens, who I happen
yes.
to know.
yes. But,
and we wish you very well. And you have a new book, Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington. And there's an excellent interview, a review of the book by Dave Zirin, a sports writer, in which he refers to you, by a comment from the book, as you had to come into the Senate as Rocky Marciano.
Yeah,
The great boxer.
And, yeah, indeed, a great champion, yes.
Right, and beat.
Oh, I must check that out. Thanks very much for telling me about that.